The U.S. is trying to keep oil from getting to Cuba. That is putting pressure on Mexico.
Mexican governments had a sort of have your cake and eat it too policy towards Cuba.
I'm Marco Werman. Today, the complicated triangle between Mexico, Cuba, and the U.S. Also on the show, a new policy from Israel's security cabinet could have huge implications for the whole region.
Many people see it as the beginning of the officially taking over the West Bank.
And Bad Bunny's Super Bowl show turned a utility pole into a symbol of Puerto Rican electricity dysfunction.
The grid is very bad. We now have 30% more outages than 3 years ago, so it continues to fail repeatedly.
Plus, the French clown who made people cry.
You are not funny.
All that and more today on The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for making it today. Carolyn Beeler is on assignment this week. Two Mexican Navy ships are on their way to Cuba. They're carrying more than 800 tons of humanitarian aid, but they don't have what Cuba needs most, oil. Basic services have screeched to a halt on the island because of severe fuel shortages. The Trump administration says Havana acts as a safe harbor for American enemies like Russia and Iran, and therefore any country providing oil to Cuba should be punished with tariffs. That's put Mexico in a tight spot. Arturo Sarucan is a former ambassador from Mexico to the U.S. When we spoke today, he told me why.
Mexico had become the largest oil provider for Cuba since last year, and more so after the extraction of Nicolás Maduro. For the previous Mexican administration and the current Mexican administration, Mexico has been sending subsidized or even in some cases free oil to Cuba, which has been roundly criticized by yours truly including, because it's propping up an authoritarian regime.
Cuba is hurting right now because of the loss of oil. I mean, I just saw a video of some planes in Havana unable to depart because there's no jet fuel. What are you seeing and hearing?
Obviously, this announcement by the Cuban authorities that they have no jet fuel and therefore cancellation of a number of flights. Canadian Airlines, which provide a significant chunk of tourists going to Cuba, have announced that they will be no longer flying to the island. This is going to deepen, I think, the chokehold on the economic situation in the island. And the situation there is dire. That's why I think we also have to understand that one of the side effects of this is the potential increase of migrant flows into the U.S. or Mexico. The other thing that I think we all have to watch out for, Marco, is that if there is a collapse of the current Cuban regime in Havana, is that Cuban intelligence is probably the most sophisticated and effective intelligence service in Latin America and the Caribbean. And the last thing you want is a repeat of what we saw when the Soviet Union collapsed, when former agents of the KGB bled into transnational criminal organizations across the globe. The one thing you don't want to see happening in the Americas is former Cuban intelligence officials finding new jobs with transnational criminal organizations operating in the Americas.
President Claudia Sheinbaum of Mexico has been speaking out against U.S. economic pressure on Cuba. She says it's wrong to choke off a country like this. What are the ties between Mexico and Cuba historically?
Well, Mexico was one of the very, very few countries that resisted U.S. pressure to break diplomatic relations with Cuba after the Castro Revolution. And successive Mexican government had a have your cake and eat it too policy towards Cuba. On the one hand, they provided important diplomatic cover. They maintained close relations with the Castro regime, both Fidel and then Raul. But at the same time, and there's ample documentation in this regard, they also allowed access of intelligence regarding Cuban activities in Mexico and elsewhere in the region to U.S. intelligence agencies. And so there was a bit of a double game here, simply because obviously the weight and the heft of the U.S.-Mexico bilateral relationship. But this deepened in 2018 when the previous and now current Mexican governments, Morena, which is the party in power since 2018, they doubled down on their relationship with Cuba for ideological reasons, for domestic political reasons in Mexico. There's a very hard left wing of Morena that sees this sort of as a Rubicon in Mexico's foreign policy, a red line. And they've been putting pressure on President Sheinbaum not to bend the knee when it comes to what the U.S. is requesting Mexico to suspend shipments of oil to Cuba.
I'm speaking with Arturo Sarucan, former Mexican ambassador to Washington, about the links between Mexico, Cuba, and the U.S. around oil shipments to Cuba. So a few weeks ago, Sheinbaum said she continued to send oil to Cuba. There were a couple of ships that went, seemingly following some of that history, but now she's ruled that out. What is the pressure that she's facing?
As with most things in the U.S.-Mexico bilateral relationship today, Marco, this is a domino of concessions linked to punitive tariffs by the Trump administration. What Trump has done from day one in the relationship with Mexico is to weaponize interdependence between Mexico and the United States. And so this issue, Mexico's position towards Cuba, has become just one more of those issues, like fentanyl and immigration, that Trump has used to put pressure on the Mexican government to agree to his positions and to his demands on a number of fronts. And this is the newest one.
So not long after Trump entered his second term at the White House, Claudia Sheinbaum was seen to be successfully appealing to his ego. What has changed?
If you compare what President Trump has said about Claudia Sheinbaum and what he says about other world leaders, I think Claudia Sheinbaum has gone off pretty well. She's unscathed. He talks highly about her, but at the same time, he is weaponizing interdependence. He's linking disparate policy issues to put pressure on Mexico. He continues to assert that she's afraid to take on organized crime, that Mexico is controlled by criminal organizations. And so it's a bit of a double discourse.
So let's just underscore that this oil blockade by the U.S. is against a backdrop of a widespread belief that Washington's goal under Trump is to force a collapse of Cuba's government. Sheinbaum must see that. Can she stop it from happening? Does she want to stop it from happening?
I think her instinct is to prevent that from happening for ideological reasons. At the same time, there are national security and immigration factors that play into this. The reverberation effects of a collapse of the current authoritarian regime in Cuba would have, I think, very important, relevant impacts across the Caribbean basin. The U.S. and Mexico particularly would be impacted. So I think her instinct is to try and prevent that. I think it's primarily driven for ideological reason, the closeness between her party and the Cuban regime. But at the same time, there's little wiggle room for her. She could play a role in trying to work hand in hand with the U.S. administration to engage with Cuba's authorities and to try and find an off-ramp that will allow some form of transition that doesn't create an explosion and a collapse in Cuba.
How are other countries in the region looking at Cuba's current situation, Arturo? Are they taking note of Sheinbaum's dealings with Trump, and what sort of lessons are they drawing?
There's been a bit of a shift in the region simply because of the recent elections, where we've seen sort of a pendular movement to the right. But the problem at the end of the day is that I've never seen an era of intra-American affairs where Latin America and the Caribbean's ability to provide something akin to a common position to coordinate a policy front vis-a-vis the United States is completely diminished, because all of these countries have become very inward-looking. I've said always that Latin America tends to punch below its weight in the international arena. Well, these last years, Latin America is not getting up even onto the ring. And so there's very little appetite and bandwidth, I think, in the region right now to provide sort of a united front, to provide other scenarios and other options for policymaking towards Cuba.
Arturo Sarucan there, former ambassador from Mexico to Washington and now senior advisor to the Americas Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Social media giants may soon be losing a lot of young eyes in Spain. The Spanish government has announced it's banning people under the age of 16 from online platforms like TikTok, Instagram, and YouTube, among others. Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez, speaking at a summit in Dubai last week, said the internet is a bad, unpoliced space for kids.
Space of addiction, abuse, pornography, manipulation, violence. We will no longer accept that. We will protect them from the digital Wild West.
Spain follows the lead of Australia, where a similar social media ban began in December. From Barcelona, the world's Jerry Haddon reports.
Spanish teens are no different from others. They often spend hours a day scrolling through videos on their phones.
Yo pienso que al día puede ser que tres horas, pero en plan
I think I'm on my phone about 3 hours a day, a 14-year-old named Jared tells me, though it's less, he says, when I'm hanging out with my friends. Jared has heard about Spain's looming ban on socials, and he doesn't like it. It's parents who should be putting limits on our phone use, he says, not the government blocking us entirely. Jared's on his way to soccer practice with a couple of friends. This is Adri, also 14. I think the government's right when it says that social media is addictive, he says. But the upcoming ban is too drastic, he says. It's going to hit hard. Adri and Jared agree to speak with me, in part because they're friends with another kid with an overused smartphone, our 14-year-old son, Emil. It's true that there's some illegal and dangerous stuff online, he says, like pedophiles or bullies and so on. But he says the government is only focusing on the bad things, not the good. Like connecting with friends, making new ones, or just having a good laugh, he says. Emil's right. Sanchez does think the bad far outweighs the good. He wants to hold internet executives criminally responsible for not removing harmful content posted on their platforms. You know, guys like Elon Musk, owner of X. On X, he responded, "Dirty Sanchez is a tyrant." Or Pavel Durov, the founder of Telegram, he wrote that Sanchez is turning Spain into a surveillance state.
A los tecnoligarcas que quiten sus sucias manos de los móviles de nuestros menores.
To which Sanchez replied at a Socialist Party rally with young supporters, "High-tech titans, keep your dirty hands off our children's cell phones." Sanchez is clearly not backing down or watering down his plan, because most grown-up Spaniards support limits on children's access to the socials. But Sanchez does face other hurdles, like how do you implement and enforce any internet ban based on age?
És molt difícil d'implementar. Ara mateix no tenim els recursos per poder assegurar que la verificació...
Fran Laluesa is a researcher at the Barcelona Open University. He says pulling this off will be tough. At the moment, he says, Spain doesn't have the resources to ensure that a social media company's age verification program is really working. So this could all just be a paper tiger, he says, destined to fail from the start. As it has in Australia, La Luesa says. The government there launched the world's first social media ban for under-16s in December. The results so far, a mixed bag. Authorities say it's working. They say about 5 million teens have seen their social media accounts go dark. But a lot of those same adolescents will tell you there's more than one way to skirt a ban.
So Snapchat, I scanned my face months ago and said I'm all good. So, you know, that was pretty easy.
This is 16-year-old Australian Noah Jones speaking to a TV reporter after the ban had been implemented.
Then TikTok didn't give me any warnings or even like tell me about the ban, which is okay. Instagram, I did get banned on one account and then I just made a new one.
Jones is suing his government on free speech grounds. He didn't explain how he made his new Instagram account, but other teens have said they've used their parents' ID, say a driver's license, to create a false adult profile. Then there are VPNs, those virtual networks that mask your true location. They're easy to set up and program to say you're in another country without restrictions. Australian authorities point out their ban is less than 2 months old, that there will be holes to plug. In the meantime, it's rolling out more safety measures, including some to rein in artificial intelligence. Julie Inman-Grant is in charge of online safety in Australia. With the new ban, she's been speaking to lots of reporters.
In 2 months, we will have some standards coming in that will require AI companions and chatbots to prevent under 18s from receiving any prompts that encourage suicidal ideation, self-harm, disordered eating, violence, or explicit pornography.
So what we've seen so far is actually just the beginning of the restrictions.
Yep. It's just the beginning.
Back in Europe, momentum is building for more bans. France and the UK are watching Spain closely. The European Union has rolled out its own age verification system for member states to use. But it isn't all harmony on the continent. Spain's Sanchez also wants to make it illegal for platforms to tweak algorithms to amplify illegal content or give traction to hate messages. Such offenses would be punishable by jail. But that contradicts Europe's Digital Services Act, which only contemplates fines. Spain's legislation goes up for a first vote next week. For The World, I'm Sherry Haddon, Barcelona.
You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. We're diving back now into our special coverage of the war in Ukraine 4 years on. Two acclaimed films documenting that war were produced here at GBH by our colleagues at Frontline. They are incredible films. They also show how hard it is to document war while you're in the proverbial fog of it. Yesterday, reporter Deborah Amos took us back to a crucial moment in 2022 when Ukrainians realized that to beat Russia, they were going to have to tell the story of what Russia was doing and to tell it well. Today, she picks up where she left off with an exploration of who hears competing stories and why that matters. Here's Deborah.
When the lights go down in a New York film festival this fall, the documentary 2,000 Meters to Andvika transports the audience to the battlefield.
There is a forest in eastern Ukraine. A narrow strip of trees squeezed between two minefields. The only way to Andriivka. This is the story of this forest and the people who will remain there forever.
Director Mstislav Chernov traveled 2,000 meters, a little more than a mile, with a platoon whose aim was to reclaim a strategic village from the Russians and hang a Ukrainian flag on the ruins.
The first scene that we are opening with is a 10-minute sequence in a forest that we'll spend the entire film in. It's a 10-minute sequence that sends us to maybe an opening of the Saving Private Ryan cinematically. But it's real. It's so real.
The power of the film comes from innovations on the battlefield, drone footage, and helmet cams. Chernoff and his team collected 100 hours of helmet footage and wove those images into the narrative.
One of the soldiers tells us, "I don't remember anything from the battle, but the GoPro remembers for me. The camera remembers for me." So it is a reconstruction of those memories, shocking memories.
The film is unsparing in showing terror on the battlefield and the terrible and sometimes pointless cost of this war. Andvika is Chernov's latest production after his film from besieged Mariupol won an Oscar in 2023. He overlapped with Lithuanian filmmaker Mantas Kvedaravicius, who was killed while trying to leave that embattled city.
People who caught and tortured and killed Mantas, they knew about us too. So they were looking for us too. Right now, if you have a camera in your hand, you will be a target.
Modern wars are fought with drones, artillery, supply chains, and soldiers, but also with narratives told by storytellers, and they both pay a price.
Mostly nightmares. Mostly Mariupol. Mostly.
Ask Hanna Bilibrova, who went to Mariupol with Mantas to document the story at the beginning of the Russian invasion. There, Mantas was arrested and executed, a nightmare she lives with to this day.
I have PTSD, and PTSD is like also followed with flashbacks. It's kind of nasty, but it's like body, it's like smell, and then like panic attack. Okay, we're fine, we're here. That's what I'm still experiencing. So Mariupol like still with me.
The story of Mariupol, the story of Andriivka, is about who is winning and whose version of events the world believes. Information is the second battlefield. A Ukrainian platoon raising a flag in a devastated village can be more than just raising a flag.
Because a picture is a symbol. The symbol cannot be taken away. It will remain in history. So all the way through the forest, we hide our cameras, we hide a flag, because we know if Russians see us from the drones, they will target us and they will kill us.
When this documentary premiered in Ukraine, the audience included war veterans, soldiers, their families, and the general public. More than 70,000 came to the theaters. It was a number one hit in the country. But the audience that counts is at U.S. film festivals and a streaming contract with public television that began late last year. Ukraine is highly effective at shaping Western opinion, but its influence stops almost completely at Russia's borders. Just ask the pollsters.
It's been remarkably consistent, quite pro-Putin, quite pro-war.
In his office in Princeton, political scientist Gregor Popelikesh has piles of graphs and charts on his desk. He runs a project that conducts online opinion surveys in Russia.
About 65% are in favor of the war. You have about 25% who are against the war and about 10% who refuse to answer.
Ukraine believes that they are in a narrative war with Russia. Do you think that Russia sees it as the same war?
There's an important narrative war vis-a-vis the West, and I think that is really important. I don't know that the Ukrainians really think that they're going to change the minds of average Russians on this.
His surveys show Russians overwhelmingly get their news from state television. It's been kind of a sealed media landscape for decades, especially with Russia's version of the Ukraine story that accelerated with the Russian invasion of Crimea in 2014.
The main story is that this is something that the Russian regime has been working on for quite a while.
Alternative viewpoints do exist, but are heavily restricted, drowned out by legal and social pressure. Russian state television claims this war is defensive, that Ukraine is a puppet of the West, and there's more.
One of them is that the Ukrainian leadership are mostly Nazis, and between 65 and 70% of Russians believe that to be true. Or that the war is, this is NATO and the U.S. and Western aggression against Russia. But what is clear is that they built this entire mentality of being under siege, and Ukraine was one part of this Western plot against Russia.
The way the Kremlin presents it, this war is a necessity. And this is reflected in public support, even as the casualties mount.
13-14% have a relative or friend who has died, and 28% have an acquaintance who has died. Died, not injured. It's not clear that that actually undermines support for the war.
The information war won't deliver a decisive knockout. This is a war of attrition, much like the military campaign itself. But the real battle begins after the war is over, says Mstislav Chernov.
Because history is not what happened, it's what we remember collectively and what was recorded. And so that's when journalists, that's when the filmmakers who recorded real events come forward. And that's when the real fight starts.
Russia aims to outlast Western attention. Ukraine aims to outlast Russian confidence. But both sides know it is possible to win the narrative and still lose the war. For The World, I'm Deborah Amos.
This reporting was supported by the International Women's Media Foundation's Women on the Ground Reporting from Ukraine's Unseen Frontlines initiative in partnership with the Howard G. Buffett Foundation. You're with The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. The Israeli government is taking steps to expand its control over the West Bank. On Sunday, members of Israel's security cabinet met behind closed doors and agreed on a range of new policies, policies that will make it easier, among other things, for Jewish Israelis to acquire Palestinian land. Israel's far-right finance minister, Bezalel Smotrich, celebrated the changes, saying, "We will continue to kill the idea of a Palestinian state." Critics say the new Israeli policy amounts to de facto annexation of parts of the West Bank. The World's Matthew Bell reports.
The new measures would overturn an old pre-1967 law that prohibits the sale of West Bank land to anyone except local Palestinians. Hanan Greenwood, who lives in a Jewish settlement outside of Ramallah, says repealing that law just makes good sense.
The problem is like this. Sometimes the Arabs want to sell lands and they can't.
They can't, Greenwood says, only because a prospective buyer happens to be Jewish.
It's only right, it makes sense that somebody that owns the land could sell it, and it can't be possible that just because he's a Jew, he can't sell his land.
The old law was put in place by Jordan, which occupied the West Bank up until the Six-Day War of 1967. Greenwood says he knows about land near Ofra, the settlement where he lives, that may now finally be put up for sale under the new Israeli policy.
There's a lot of areas that are private-owned properties of Palestinians since before the Six-Day War. And they are, I don't know if they live around anymore. Probably most of them live in Jordan. Until now, they didn't have the option if they wanted. I'm not forcing anybody, but if they wanted, they didn't have the option to sell their land.
And now, he says, they will have that option. For many Palestinians, though, this is about more than real estate. Father Bashar Fawadla, a priest from the Palestinian Christian village of Taibe, tells me that the new Israeli policies are the most dangerous in decades.
Many people see it as the beginning of the officially taking over the West Bank.
Beyond the issue of land sales, Fawadla says the new measures will undermine the semi-autonomous U.S.-backed Palestinian Authority.
Many administrative and civil responsibilities are being moved from Palestinian control to Israeli military occupation institution, even in areas that were supposed to be under Palestinian management.
Israeli authorities would be responsible for security and infrastructure in areas that were previously owned and overseen by the Palestinians. Fawadla says this is all connected to the expansion of Jewish settlements in the West Bank. That process has accelerated since the Hamas attack of October 7, 2023. Israeli authorities, Fawadla says, have also stepped up house demolitions and road closures. That's having a negative impact on daily life for Palestinians. And he points to one more aspect of these new measures approved by the Security Cabinet.
Israel is taking full control of important religious sites, including the Ibrahim Mosque in Hebron. Palestinian authorities are losing their role there. This affects people's religious and cultural rights.
That mosque shares a location with the Cave of the Patriarchs, a Jewish holy site. Hebron has been a flashpoint for the Israeli-Palestinian conflict for many years. The city is home to the largest Palestinian population in the West Bank. That part of the city includes a small, hardline group of Israeli settlers protected by the Israeli army. Shayna Lowe is with the Norwegian Refugee Council. She's based in Amman, Jordan. She says Israel's new policies for the West Bank may not explicitly use the word annexation, but that's what they amount to.
I think that the big shift here that we're seeing is that this is really a very overt rejection of the Oslo Accords, an agreement that Israel signed more than 30 years ago. And we're seeing now that the government, rather than enacting policies without stating them, we're now seeing more of a willingness to be on the record saying, we are doing this.
Far-right ministers in Israel's government are calling for the state to declare sovereignty over large parts of the West Bank. This is an election year in Israel, so that sort of rhetoric is likely to continue. The White House just reiterated its opposition to that idea. A statement issued on Sunday said, President Trump has clearly stated that he does not support Israel annexing the West Bank. Trump will have an opportunity to discuss all of this with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu when he arrives in Washington later this week. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell.
Bad Bunny's halftime performance at the Super Bowl, what can we say? It was historic in many ways.
Maldita sea, otro pagón, vamos para los bleachers a prender un blon, antes que vivo le de un bofe, Puerto Rico está en casa.
The proudly Puerto Rican musician performed on an elaborate set, bringing a diverse group of Latino singers and dancers onto a football field that looked like a sugarcane plantation, a preface to a multi-layered homage to symbols of Puerto Rican culture and history. We wanted to focus on one moment when Bad Bunny scaled an electrical utility pole during the song El Apagón, or The Blackout. It was a nod to Puerto Rico's chronic power outages. When Hurricane Maria hit Puerto Rico in 2017, it caused the longest blackout in U.S. history. Some parts of the island went without power for nearly a year. It's been almost a decade since, and along with that image of Bad Bunny on the pole, it made us want to check in on the island's energy grid. Ruth Santiago is an environmental and community lawyer. She joined us from Salinas, Puerto Rico. Ruth, how would you describe the status of the power grid on the island today?
The service is very bad. There's a recent report indicating that we now have 30% more outages than 3 years ago.
Would you say it fully recovered from Hurricane Maria?
No, absolutely not. Especially after Luma Energy took over operation of the transmission and distribution system, the service has become worse. More interruptions, more blackouts, apagones, as Bad Bunny called them.
Right. I want to get to Luma Energy in just a moment. But just first, remind us what happened in 2017 with Hurricane Maria and how people in Puerto Rico got through it.
The hurricane had tremendous force and came in and knocked out a lot of the poles and wires and towers and flooded the substations.
We should recall that that was not the beginning of Puerto Rico's power woes. Let's call it more of a recent chapter in that story. How would you describe the underlying problem with Puerto Rico's electrical grid generally?
It's a very centralized system. So we have a lot of power plants here in the south, in southern Puerto Rico, and a lot of transmission lines running across the island over to the north where the capital is, or San Juan metropolitan area. And so, as I mentioned, hurricanes usually come in through the east. So these transmission lines and towers and poles and wires are struck down repeatedly over many, many decades. Another big problem was that the investment in the grid was not kept up, and so maintenance was not being done as should have been. And so when Hurricane Maria came in, there were no spare parts.
Earlier you mentioned Luma Energy. Let's get back to that, because 9 months after Hurricane Maria, the Puerto Rico Electric Power Authority, PREPA, that's the publicly owned utility in the territory, they declared bankruptcy ever since Puerto Rico's tried to privatize power. In 2021, Luma Energy, which you mentioned, this private Canadian-American company, took control of power transmission. How has that been going?
That has not been going well. And actually, in 2020, Luma Energy got a full year of apprenticeship, let's say, of being paid to learn about our grid before taking over in June 2021. And when they did, we immediately started to see that they were not prepared. And so what we've seen are dozens of really massive power outages. When I say massive, over 100,000 clients, electric clients here, like residences, businesses, schools, everything, without power.
So in Donald Trump's second term, has any federal funding come through to bolster the island's power grid, to provide maintenance, or to support that decentralizing idea?
On the contrary, Donald Trump just eliminated some funding that had been allocated for distributed renewable energy for very low-income people and hospitals and nursing homes and things like that.
And Ruth, what do the constant blackouts, the outages, the apagones, what does that all that mean for people in Puerto Rico?
Well, usually it means excess deaths, right? So after Hurricane Maria, we saw, one estimate is about 3,000 excess deaths, mostly related to lack of access to medical equipment that needs to be energized and, refrigeration for medications and things related to not having electric service.
3,000, that's an extraordinary number.
Yeah, there's another estimate that is much higher, but the government accepted that 2,975 people died after Hurricane Maria, during and after.
Yeah. We heard earlier a little bit of the song El Apagón, a Bad Bunny's song, and the lyrics translate roughly to, "Damn it, another blackout. Let's go to the bleachers and light up a blunt before I give Pipo a slap." Pipo, that is a reference to Puerto Rico's former governor, Pedro Pierluisi. Why is he being singled out?
He was in a line, actually, of governors who promoted this Luma contract, who has doubled down on the rebuild of the same centralized, fossil-fired grid that has not worked for us in the past 20 years.
If I can ask you, Ruth, you've spent a good deal of your life working to hold Puerto Rican authorities accountable for failing to improve the island's electric grid. What went through your mind when you saw Bad Bunny scaling that electrical pole in his halftime performance on Sunday night?
Well, we certainly appreciate him highlighting this issue. I think that often now it is still threatening lives here in Puerto Rico, lives and livelihoods. Just watching people live without power is not easy.
Ruth Santiago is a lawyer in Salinas, Puerto Rico. The rings of a tree are not the only parts that can reveal history. If you've ever walked through the woods in the fall and noticed the spiky little balls that fall on the ground, they fall from chestnut trees found pretty much all across the Northern Hemisphere. But chestnut trees have not always been so widespread. Research into ancient chestnut pollen deposits show a rapid spread of the trees across Europe about 2,000 years ago. Swiss forestry experts say it suggests an intentional campaign of tree planting that matches the rise of the Roman Empire. Duri Buscarin reports from Istanbul.
All right, we are here in Belgrade Forest. It's this big nature preserve on the edge of Istanbul. Environmentalists often call it the lungs of the city. And it's too late in the season right now, but in the late fall, you will see people all over this park collecting chestnuts. They fall from the trees with a big spiky husk, and then you peel it apart, and there's this smooth, almost lacquery brown nut. Chestnuts are a key part of a Mediterranean winter at its best. They're cooked with meat or rice, candied for dessert, roasted and sold on the street from little red trolleys. One particularly photogenic vendor went viral this winter as tourists lined up to take photos with him. But the widespread availability of chestnuts in Europe is likely a human intervention, says Swiss forestry expert Patrick Krebs.
This was a revolution in the landscape.
Krebs and his colleagues at the Swiss Federal Institute for Forest, Snow, and Landscape Research studied the distribution of ancient pollen deposits to figure this out. During the last ice age, chestnut trees nearly went extinct. Only pockets of them survived in Anatolia, southern Italy, Georgia.
It was just scattered in the forest.
Then, around the first century BCE, the percentage of chestnut tree pollen in the atmosphere started to grow rapidly, especially in the Alps, on a timeline that matches the Roman conquest of Europe.
Reaching maximum of percentage that are at around 30 or even 50% of all pollen data. It means that they changed completely the forest landscape.
There's a small layer of microcharcoal in the pollen record, Krebs says, which strongly suggests that old-growth forests were burned and then replanted with chestnut trees, likely imported by invading Roman armies. The trees were excellent for cutting timber because they resprout after being cut, and they were an abundant food source. Classical texts tell us that wealthier Romans snubbed the nuts. They were once called bread of the poor. Local communities quickly incorporated them into their diets. They were low-calorie, but had lots of fiber and vitamin C. And Krebs says that where he is, in Switzerland, they're considered a deeply traditional food.
Each year I go in the forest collecting some chestnut. I eat maybe 10 fresh chestnut. Then I like to produce some cake with chestnut flour, but it's nothing compared to before.
But today, Krebs says, the modern world is taking its toll. Chestnut trees are affected by climate change and blight, and the local knowledge of how to care for the trees is starting to fade.
We have no more this manpower to continue to maintain all the chestnut forests. They are declining, but very slowly.
Back in Istanbul, there's a small village nestled in the forest on the edge of the city. During a weekly farmer's market, Firat Karaytlı sells fresh chestnuts for about $5 a pound.
Oraya gittiğimizde kestane ağaçları mı vardı? Ben çok fazla hatırlamıyorum.
He has memories of visiting his grandmother's village as a kid and gathering chestnuts in the fall, he tells me. He still eats them every winter, but they're a little too pricey for a daily snack.
Kestanenin şöyle bıçakla bir tane çizik atıyoruz kestaneye.
He carefully tells me how to prepare them, and I take home a small bag. And on one particularly cold and gray afternoon, I score the bottoms with a sharp knife and throw them into the oven for 20 minutes. They come out piping hot, the shells unfurling to reveal the roasted chestnut inside. They're nutty, filling, and just a little sweet. I can see why the Romans always wanted them nearby. For the world, I'm Duri Buscarin, Istanbul.
Philippe Gollier was a clown, but also a teacher who inspired some of today's comedic greats.
Bad student. Horrible physically. You are too noisy. You are like a bad farmer. You are like a mop to clean the floor.
That's from a documentary about Gollier's unique teaching style. He felt it was important to tell unfunny students the truth. If you want to stay boring all your life, he told the New York Times in 2022, you will never be a clown. Sometimes he delivered the bad news with words, sometimes with a drum. Here's one of his former students, Sacha Baron Cohen, best known for his Borat character on Late Night with Seth Meyers, explaining how the drum worked.
People would fly from around the world. There were people from Australia had flown to study with him. And then basically the first thing you would do is you put on some clown music, you put on your red nose, go around the room. If he hit his drum, you would have to sit down.
By all accounts, it was brutal.
They start speaking and he hits his drum because they're not funny and they would burst into tears and hate it.
But Cohen, like many others, found it useful.
I'm still in contact with him and I'll call him up and I go, what do you think? How was that? And he'll often go, well, not good. You were not funny.
Philippe Gollier was born in Paris in 1943 and became famous in the 1970s with a show called Les Assiettes, where he and his comedic partner broke plates.
We broke 200 plates every night.
200 broken plates, that was the bit. Gollier died yesterday at 82. His legacy lives on with other famous students like Emma Thompson and Helena Bonham Carter. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Colombia's La Guajira region on the Caribbean coast is largely indigenous. It's also one of the poorest parts of the country, with high rates of food insecurity. In one small indigenous community, a miraculous bean has planted seeds of hope. Now this little legume is bringing about change in other communities in the region and even worldwide. Natalie Scoland reports from Ishashimana, Colombia.
It's lunchtime for students at the only school in this small village. 16-year-old Natalia Isabel Mengual is finishing her plate. I can't help but be a bit nosy. I'm curious what she's eating.
Arroz con lenteja.
Today's specialty, she says, is rice with lentils. I'm here on the hunt for a different legume that helped put the small town of Ishashimana and its school on the map. It's called
el frijol guajiro.
The guajiro bean. That was the Ishashimana school's founder, Rita Viviana Uriana. The small, speckled bean comes in an array of colors, from blue to brown, white or gray. This legume is a traditional crop of the indigenous Wayuu who live here. The bean has adapted over generations to extreme conditions in this coastal desert region. It can be ready to harvest in as little as 3 months and produces pods for as many as 8 months after that.
El frijol es una leguminosa con un alto valor proteico.
In fact, you can eat the bean at any stage of growth. The bean contains a lot of protein, according to Liliana Vargas with the international nonprofit Slow Food. Not only that, but it's got plenty of fiber and minerals. The guajiro bean's deep roots allow it to persevere through flooding and times of drought. So it offered a way to help reduce hunger and food insecurity in the community. But even a bean this tough is having a harder time lately.
Precisamente por las condiciones específicas.
Precisely because of the climatic conditions in La Guajira, Vargas says. A major multi-year drought in the 2010s wrought havoc on crops and native seeds. A 2023 government report estimated rainfall in La Guajira diminished by as much as 80%, and rainy seasons have become highly unpredictable. Liliana Vargas says it's fueled an ongoing food security crisis.
El departamento de La Guajira y específicamente las comunidades Wayuu han vivido en crisis alimentaria desde hace mucho tiempo.
Vargas says La Guajira still has some of the highest rates of malnutrition in Colombia and staggering numbers of deaths among children and the elderly due to food scarcity. About a decade ago, Ishashimana leaders worked with Vargas's team at Slow Food to reintegrate the guajiro bean into their school garden. In Ishashimana, the rejuvenated bean has offered a way to help sustain the whole community.
Nos fuimos dando cuenta que el frijol guajiro era muy resistente a las sequías.
Jorge Gutierrez from one of the United Nations agriculture programs came to La Guajira to study Wayuu food traditions. He says his team discovered that the guajiro bean is especially drought tolerant. Now, they've integrated modern technology with traditional agriculture to help this ancient bean better survive in the modern world. Program leaders with the United Nations have helped develop water wells in communities across La Guajira to ensure plants can weather times of drought. They also offer agricultural training opportunities for locals. A few villages now have their own weather stations to keep track of local precipitation levels and other metrics. The goal is to leave the bean crops fully in the hands of residents within the next year. At the school garden in Ishashimana, students and community members pitch in to plant a variety of traditional crops. Garden work is part of students' academic schedules, a way to offer hands-on experience graduates can eventually bring back to their hometowns. After all, there's a lot that goes into keeping the plot healthy.
Como el compostaje, la creación de la hechura de abonos orgánicos.
Like composting and making organic fertilizers, Vargas says. The goal is to eventually be able to feed the school's 1,800 students and the surrounding community, and even offer new local sources of income from surplus crops.
El mejor indicador es que no estemos.
The greatest indicator is to see the project continue after we leave, the UN's Gutierrez says. Versions of this climate-adapted agricultural model have been implemented in other parts of the world. In Thailand, farmers received new technology to help track weather patterns that impact crop yield. Senegalese farmers learned new composting techniques to boost soil health. Closer to home, Gutierrez says countries like Nicaragua, Ecuador, and Peru have all expressed interest. One thing that will probably change between countries and communities? The bean.
Cada país o comunidad podría encontrar sus propias rutas y ajustar las metodologías a lo local.
Each country can adjust the model and find their own ways to meet local needs, he says. In Ishashimana, Rita Oriana pushes open a wooden gate and maneuvers past brush and branches. This is the 10-acre garden where the guajiro bean took off all those years ago. Today, other plants traditional to Wayuu gastronomy grow alongside the beloved bean crop.
La patilla. La auyama.
Watermelon, pumpkin, she says. It's not always easy, but as she puts it, our ancestral knowledge of how to plant seeds makes us stronger. For the world, I'm Natalie Skoland in Ishashimana, Colombia.
A new bridge between the U.S. and Canada that has been under construction for 7 years is ready to open to car, foot, and bicycle traffic this year. The Gordie Howe Bridge, named after the legendary Canadian hockey player, connects Detroit with Windsor, Ontario, but President Trump is threatening to stop it from opening. In a lengthy rant posted to Truth Social last night, Trump lashed out at his northern neighbors. He said Canada is taking advantage of America and that the U.S. must be, quote, fully compensated. He added that the U.S. should own at least half of the bridge. The bridge is, in fact, jointly owned by the two countries, even though Canada footed the $5.7 billion bill for the project. So will this rant have consequences?
I don't think it's going to have any bearing on when the bridge opens. It's just Trump being Trump.
That's Rob Trembouillac, a Canadian steel worker who helped construct the bridge. He says the bridge is a great example of cross-border collaboration. One side was built by a Canadian crew and the other by the U.S.
We had like a really cool day where we met the Americans in the middle and connected the last piece. That's kind of when it all came together and you really, really did feel the pride and the magnitude.
Earlier today, Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney said he had a positive talk with Trump and reminded him that Canada paid for the bridge. We'll be covering this bridge and what it could mean for cross-border travel and trade between the U.S. and Canada, especially as political tensions escalate. That'll be next week on The World. The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.
The World is supported by the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the Lumina Foundation, committed to a fair, universal system for learning beyond high school that offers every American the chance for a better life. LuminaFoundation.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Judy Pigott, the Gruber Family Foundation, the Schmidt Family Foundation, and Gavin Salmanese, LLC. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.